Welcome to Enterprise Radio, the signature show of the Enterprise Podcast Network, featuring some of the most prominent business professionals in the world today. And now your host, Eric Dye.
This is Eric Dye, and once again, welcome to Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN, the Enterprise Podcast Network. Today on the program, we're visiting with Dr. Christopher D. Kalinda, PhD, the founder of the Strategic Leaders Academy. He works with leaders who wants to apply insights from history and military operations to transform their businesses. A West Point graduate, recognized combat leader, and retired Army colonel, he defied conventional wisdom in Afghanistan by motivating a large insurgent group to switch sides, the only example of such success in the 20-year history of the war. As a trusted advisor to 3 4-star generals and 2 undersecretaries of defense, he became the first American to have both fought the Taliban as a commander in combat and negotiated with them in peace talks. He holds a PhD in war studies from King's College London, and his newest book is Leadership, the Warrior's Art. Looking forward to this session of Enterprise Radio, and Dr. Kalinda, thanks for joining us here today.
Thank you very much for having me, Eric. I appreciate you and what you do for entrepreneurs.
Well, I certainly do appreciate those kind words, and that means a lot coming from someone like yourself. Thanks for that. So to kick things off today, Dr. Kalinda, what can we learn from the ancient Greeks and Romans about leadership? I think we could learn a lot, couldn't we?
Oh, I love the ancient Greeks and Romans because they, like all ancients from a lot of different cultures, grappled with the basics, the essence of leadership, the essence of how do you put together a society, an army, a polity that can function well together and work well together. So they're grappling with the fundamentals of human nature, of leadership, of social cohesion, and freedom. And I think that's I find oftentimes the richest thoughts on leadership come from the ancients.
Yeah, good stuff, and a great place to kick things off here today. Now, here's another question for you. What's the road to an inspiring culture?
An inspiring culture is about, and it gets back to this, our core definition of leadership, which is leaders inspire people to contribute their best to the team's success. And every element of that is vital. So leaders inspire, they don't coerce. And inspire doesn't mean, you know, walk on hot coals or anything like that. It just means you are setting the example, you are getting people to voluntarily want to contribute their best and most authentic selves. And to do so for a core purpose, which is for the team's success. And so building an inspiring culture is a vital part of that. You could look at culture as one of 4 types. And so if you imagine a double axis chart, with the north-south axis being clarity about your organization's common good. So your common good are things like mission and vision, goals and values, standards and expectations. So that's the north-south axis. And the east-west axis is buy-in. And when you put those together, you get 4 different kinds of culture. So on the upper left, where you've got high clarity and low levels of buy-in, you have a compliance culture. And military basic training organizations are often compliance cultures. A lot of large organizations have compliance cultures, and this is where the leaders are spending all of their time looking down and in, making sure that their employees are doing their jobs. The cost of that is they're not looking up and out to strategy and growth. And so a lot of compliance organizations find that they have a fixation on the status quo, and they tend not to grow. And of course, if their competitors are innovating, then compliance organizations will tend to fall by the wayside. So think Sears in the face of innovation by Amazon. On the lower left, you've got where you've got low clarity and low buy-in is where you've got a chaotic culture. And in chaotic cultures, the office alphas are really the ones in charge. And they create their little fiefdoms, and they've got their own thing going on. And chances are that those little fiefdoms are not aligned with where you want to be as an organization. So chaotic cultures tend to have very sort of toxic, low-performing environments. Over on the lower right, where you have low clarity but high levels of buy-in, I see this with small companies all the time. You have a contingent culture. And it's contingent based on that group of founders or that group of original partners staying in the organization and at the right levels of concentration. So you've got this small group of people who maybe they've worked together for a long time, they just have this implicit understanding of the common good, so they do not feel like they have to write it down. And contingent cultures work perfectly well until one of two things happens. Either some of the original founding members leave and you have to bring in new people who don't have the same implicit understanding, or you try to scale. And as you try to scale, you bring in new people who don't have the implicit understanding. And inevitably, it happens almost every time, the backsliding goes towards the chaotic. So where you want to be, of course, is in the upper right, which is what I call an inspiring culture. And that's where you've got high levels of clarity about your common good and high levels of buy-in. And when you're there, you don't have to spend all of your time supervising and micromanaging. Leaders can look up and out towards strategy and growth. And that's where thriving organizations exist.
Yeah, I really do appreciate the coverage and thorough response in reference to the road to an inspiring culture. Now, also, what are the keys to gaining buy-in for tough decisions and difficult changes? Talk to us about that.
Yeah, so this is one that I work with people on a lot. Because it's a huge challenge, and we're in this period of Alan Weiss, one of my mentors, calls it no normal. I call it persistent abnormal, where we're in this period of volatility and uncertainty. So buy-in for tough decisions is vital. If you're to think of a three-circle Venn diagram, I think buy-in has three components. The first one is an acceptance and alignment on the common good, which is, again, your organization's mission and vision, goals and values, standards and expectations. The second circle is enlightened self-interest. So people have to see themselves as better off by staying aligned with the common good. And third is accountability. So there's got to be consequences for, good performance, proper alignment on the common good, and when things go astray. And so you've got to have all three in place. So if you looked at that Venn diagram and you labeled the intersections 1, 2, 3, and 4, you see the consequences if one is missing. So if you have clarity and buy-in, but you don't have accountability, then you're simply getting lucky. And you are at high risk of backsliding, because eventually, when there's no accountability, people are going to think the rules are arbitrary, they're selectively enforced, and you're going to have growing cynicism within the organization because of that arbitrariness. If you are in intersection number two, where you've got clarity and alignment on the common good and accountability, but you've got no buy-in, then you're back to this compliance behavior where people are just going to do enough to get by. They're not going to be focused on growth and innovation. And then if you're in circle three, where you've got buy-in and accountability, but you've got no clarity and alignment on the common good, then you're likely into fiefdoms, where people are going to do what they believe is in their own best interest, a lot of selfish behavior, but not focused on the common good of the organization. So when you've got all three in place, clarity and alignment on the common good, enlightened self-interest where people see themselves as better off, and accountability, then you've got the key ingredients for buy-in.
Certainly a unique angle on leadership. Really do appreciate the insight and information shared so far today. We're speaking with Colonel Kalinda. He is a PhD and the founder of Strategic Leaders Academy. He works with leaders who want to apply insights from history and military operations to transform their businesses. His newest book is Leadership, The Warrior's Art, and he's joined us here today on Enterprise Radio, a part of EPN, the Enterprise Podcast Network. Now, continuing on, what should leaders do to inspire people to contribute their best to the team's success?
Well, I think there are three ways that leaders learn about leadership and grow their leadership. So they learn through theory, they learn through history, and they learn through personal experience. You've got to be in the arena. Again, it's, you know, sort of like a three-legged stool. If you have a theory and history, but you've got no experience, then you're likely to just be in the ivory tower where things sound good in theory, but they just simply don't work in practice, kind of like a chocolate frying pan. If you've got theory and experience, but you've got no history, and we see this a lot today, then you are likely to just fall victim to fads. So when you think of some fads in the 1990s, the one-minute manager, management by walking around, good to great, some of these other fads, they came and went because they just simply couldn't stand the test of time. If you have history and experience, but you've got no theory, you've got no big ideas, then you're like the person who's playing chess one move at a time. And if you are up against a competitor who thinks strategically, you can think several moves ahead, then you're going to fail. So you're all tactics and no strategy. And leaders, when you combine those three, what you have is the practical imagination that you need to help to help inspire people to contribute their best. So that would be one element of the question. The second element is, and that you'll gain from the theory, history, and experience, is the importance of being an exemplar. Too often leaders today, I think, focus maybe more on privileges rather than setting the example. When you go to Civil War battlefields, you'll see that many leaders on horseback. And that's not because they were too lazy to walk. It's because they were deliberately making themselves the most vulnerable person in the formation. So if they can stand tall in the saddle under withering fire, then the rest of their subordinates would do the same. That's why Brigadier General was the deadliest rank in the American Civil War, the higher proportion of casualties among Brigadier Generals than anybody, any other rank. And that's because they were the exemplars. And the result of that in our own organizations is that people are going to look to us as leaders for guidance on the values. Are we modeling the values? Are we modeling the standards and expectations of the organization, or are we not? And if we are, people are going to take them seriously, and they're going to follow that example. If we don't, if we think the rules just simply apply to other people, but not to us as leaders, then people will take their cues from that. And pretty soon you're going to find that the things, what's happening in the halls, and on the Zoom calls is far different than the values and good ideas you've got written on the walls.
Really some strong, solid points made right there, and really do appreciate the feedback per that question as well. Now, what are the decision-making errors that keep leading America into quagmires? I'd love to hear your input on that.
It's the subject of my latest book, Zero Sum Victory, What We're Getting Wrong About War. We tend to have a very zero-sum view of victory in war, which is we win everything and the enemy gets nothing. And certainly that would be nice. We tend to view wars as the only fitting end to a war is a surrender ceremony on the battleship Missouri. And what we do in a zero-sum mentality is we foreclose a lot of options in which we gain our basic interests, and our adversary may gain some as well. So when we're pursuing a zero-sum victory in situations where it just simply isn't likely to occur, in such as in places like Vietnam, Afghanistan, and Iraq. What happens is we're just prolonging the war over and over again and missing opportunities to achieve our interests. So in Afghanistan, for instance, in 2001, the Taliban offered to surrender, and we said no. And in 2010, 11, and 12, in the negotiations I was involved with, the Taliban's demands for beginning talks with the Afghan government really modest, and our demands, you know, on them were fairly reasonable too. And this is when we had 100,000 international troops on the ground, and yet you had resistance from people within the U.S. government, people in the Afghan government, saying that we needed to, quote, negotiate from a position of strength, end quote, when we had 100,000 folks on the ground. Beam forward 10 years later, when you know, we had been withdrawing troops over that decade, and we are left making an agreement with the Taliban of no troops for promises of no terrorism, and so the zero sum mentality is what's been preventing us from seizing opportunities in which we would have gotten a favorable and durable outcome to these conflicts. And yet, as the war drags on, our leverage actually gets lower and lower. So that's part of the paradox.
Really some interesting feedback from you. Thanks for that. Now, even to tag on to that last question, what accounts for all generals and ambassadors saying that we're making progress, but the wars end up failing?
The organizational silos is the short answer. When the U.S. deploys into these conflict zones, we essentially deploy an organizational silo. So there's a Department of Defense silo, the generals, the special operations force. And often you have multiple Department of Defense silos. Department of State's got its silo. The intelligence community has their silos. And they report progress in within their own silos. But nobody is actually in charge on the ground. So when you look at, again, I'm just going to use Afghanistan as a singular example. There's nobody in charge on the ground of all the U.S. forces and capabilities. It's not the general. It's not the ambassador, or the intel chief. They all work for different people in Washington, D.C. And they've been given instructions by all those different people in Washington, D.C. So that, you know, the Department of Defense will do things like military operations against the enemy. They'll train local security forces. The Department of State will train local civil servants. USAID will build roads and schools and other infrastructure. And the intel community does its intelligence work. But because there's nobody in charge on the ground setting priorities, managing an implementation strategy, you get this situation where everybody is reporting progress in their silo, even though, and things are cascading or things are spiraling downwards, strategically. So the generals can very credibly say, we're making great progress because we've trained so many thousands of security forces. We've killed and captured so many enemy. USAID can say the same thing about roads and schools. The ambassadors can say the same thing about civil servants trained. But because you've got nobody responsible and accountable overall, that is nobody below the President of the United States, nobody in country that is responsible overall, you get this problem where everybody is reporting great progress, but things are going downhill. So in an organization, if you have a situation in which all of your direct reports are saying what great progress they're making, but things aren't improving, then you know that you've got a silo problem.
Well, this is certainly, again, an interesting angle on business and leadership. And of course, you're the author of the book, Leadership, the Warrior's Art, and Taking History and Military Operations to Transform Businesses. Again, we really have appreciated your time with us here today. As we conclude, one last question. What can business leaders take away from zero-sum victory?
Well, I think they can take a number of things. Three things in particular I'll focus on. The first one is that you make a lot more progress when you are building bridges rather than when you are digging trenches. So building bridges in your organization, getting to know people, getting to know your customers and clients, getting to know your competitors, you're going to make a lot more progress when you go to somebody else's bus stop and see things from their point of view, rather than just building, you know, trenches and moats around your own position and expecting people to come to your point of view. The second is, as we were just mentioning, avoiding the kind of organizational silos. So you want to get out of the business of fiefdoms. That's what I discussed a lot in Zero Sum Victory. You want to get out of the business of fiefdoms, and you want everybody to have a vested interest in the common good. And your reporting metrics, if you will, should focus more on the common good than in performance measures in a certain silo or fiefdom. And then third is, you've got to avoid freebasing your own gunpowder. Avoiding breathing your own exhaust, inhaling your own fumes. You've got to bring people in from the outside who have a vested interest in giving you an objective point of view and challenging your thinking. Your lieutenants within your organization are all great people. They all have a lot of incentives, oftentimes to agree with the boss. And you need somebody who is going to help you think differently about these very unique situations that we face, this volatile and uncertain environment.
Dr. and Colonel Kalinda, we really do appreciate your time spent with us here today. I'm sure listeners want to know where they could best pick up the book, Leadership the Warriors Art, as well as the Strategic Leaders Academy, and also about yourself. Where's the best place to do so?
Sure. You can find my books, Leadership the Warriors Art, Zero Sum Victory, any place where great books are sold. So whether it's bookstores or Amazon, Barnes & Noble, etc. And for Strategic Leaders Academy, just simply go to our website, strategicleadersacademy.com, and you can see all the ways that we help entrepreneurs, whether it's solo practitioners, small business owners, achieve their dreams.
Once again, listeners, it is strategicleadersacademy.com. This link will be within the show notes of this broadcast, as always. Dr. and Colonel Kalinda, all the best, and thanks so much for joining us here today on Enterprise Radio.
Thank you, Eric. It's been an absolute delight being here with you.
Well, it's been my honor and pleasure, and thanks so much. We've been speaking with, once again, Colonel and Dr. Chris Kalinda. He is the founder of the Strategic Leaders Academy. He works with leaders who want to apply insights from history and military operations to transform their businesses. His newest book is Leadership, the Warrior's Art. And for further details, visit strategicleadersacademy.com. And this is Eric Dye, and you've been listening to Enterprise Radio, part of EPN, the Enterprise Podcast Network. Tune in to our live location as we are streaming live 24/7 around the world at epodcastnetwork.com/live. You can also find our live stream on iTunes Radio and TuneIn Radio, as well as the TuneIn Radio app for your listening convenience. And as always, we thank you for your support and for tuning in.
Thanks for listening to Enterprise Radio. To subscribe to more of our programming, visit epodcastnetwork.com.
This is the ePodcast Network.